It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the unexpected increases or spikes in drug-involved overdoses here in Wisconsin and the latest approaches in harm reduction as opioids continue to be the leading cause of overdose deaths. Bring your perspective to the conversation. Call in with a question, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Rachel Giculay is an epidemiologist and assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Nursing. Rachel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for having me this morning.
So Public Health Madison and Dane County recently issued an overdose spike alert. Help us understand what qualifies as a spike.
Sure, yeah. So the spike alert that you're speaking of was issued on May 24th. In this particular spike incident, they had detected more overdoses in the community than we would have expected based on prior data around this time of year last year and, you know, the prior weeks before May 24th. And so specifically, they had had 9 overdose or potential overdose incidents involving need for Narcan. Unfortunately, 2 of those people died from the suspected overdose. And because this was more than is typically seen in the local community, they issued a spike alert to let everyone know that there may be some changes in the drug supply and recommend, you know, some behavior changes or referral to resources that might be helpful to people.
So spike alerts, very much data-driven. Anything that is wavering from the baseline data you normally see?
Yeah, that's kind of the idea. So we have some spike alerts really are kind of from this idea that if we can speed up surveillance, we can take action quickly. The trade-off is that often we have to act on very preliminary data. So we're dealing with sort of suspected overdoses based on emergency medical responses, hospital data, police records. And those are all in Madison, at least, reported to Public Health Madison and Dane County. And then an epidemiologist there is able to review those, compare to prior data, and determine if we're seeing more than we would expect.
And you always want to find out the cause, why a recent overdose spike. Is there any inclination you know what is causing that in Dane County?
Well, I think broadly speaking, we have seen for several years that fentanyl, illicitly manufactured fentanyl specifically, has contaminated our drug supply. That's an opioid that's much, much more potent than heroin and sort of enters our drug supply in unpredictable amounts. So over time, there may be more or less fentanyl in our local drug supply. It's very hard to predict that. And so sometimes we see these indications through an increase in overdoses. So one cause is really just this kind of instability and variation in the amount of fentanyl in the drug supply. More recently, though, we've seen other really concerning trends where other drugs are entering the drug supply. One of them is called xylazine. And then as well, we've seen illicitly manufactured fentanyl not just entering the heroin supply, but also the cocaine and methamphetamine supplies in Wisconsin and nationwide. And so kind of all put together, this sort of instability and lack of predictability of the drug supply is really what can cause these spikes to occur. I will say for any particular event, it's very difficult in real time to have the data you would need to know what's going on because we don't necessarily have that real-time testing of the drug supply or that data available to public health to make these decisions.
Sometimes you might hear about a bad batch of drugs, and I use bad batch in air quotes, that terminology sometimes out there. It could that be because it fentanyl might be to blame there, or what might that mean as public health experts trying to trace back to get a clearer cause of the spike?
Yeah, for sure. So this idea that, you know, there's a bad batch circulating and it may be in our community for a week or two, That's definitely the idea behind the spikes. And again, like I said, those things can kind of vary, and it's really hard to predict, when we might have a bad batch in the local community without looking at those overdose deaths, because data that's more confirmatory, like from the medical examiner testing people after they've unfortunately passed away, or testing at kind of point of care for some of those newer substances on the market like xylazine, that's really difficult to do, and we don't necessarily have the resources available to get that sort of confirmatory answer about what's in this bad batch today.
Talking about reducing fatal drug overdoses with Rachel Gicule, who is an epidemiologist at UW-Madison and its School of Nursing. You can join in with your questions, your comments along the way. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Are these overdose spike alerts reaching the people who need them most, Rachel?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? I will say I've been really encouraged that in Wisconsin and really nationwide, but in Wisconsin especially, we've seen some of the opioid settlement funds go to increasing the capacity of these sort of spike alert systems at the local level. And the opioid settlement funds, what I'm speaking of there is the more than $400 million that the state has gotten from settling with lawsuits related to drugs like prescription drugs like oxycodone. But yeah, so now we are seeing some investment in those systems that I think will result in meaningful evaluation. But unfortunately, they're a little bit too new and sort of implemented differently throughout the country that we don't have that super clear answer yet about whether people are able to change their behavior. I will say some of the early data suggests that people do find this information helpful, but they need to be able to have the resources to act on that behavior change. So, for example, when I spoke earlier about xylazine being a potential new contaminant in the drug supply, there are xylazine test strips out there, but we don't have them available locally yet through places like our certain service programs or the public health department. We do give out fentanyl test strips, and those are wonderful, but I think we're still sort of connecting the dots between we have a spike and then we have all needed resources for someone to really make that behavior change to maybe use a drug slower or test their drugs for a novel substance.
A follow-up there, though. Are fentanyl testing strips available enough? Are they having an impact on the problem?
Yeah, well, I think again, kind of going back to the opioid settlement funds, the state has made some more resources available to purchase those and to distribute them for free through our harm reduction programs and through public health. We know that people, especially several years ago when illicitly manufactured fentanyl was newly contaminating the heroin supply, could find that information helpful. And really, at an individual level, we're talking about, the person making a decision to maybe do like a test dose first before they use the full amount of a drug they've purchased, or to just use slower, to not use alone when they detect fentanyl. But now that illicitly manufactured fentanyl is really widely spread through the opioid supply, it's, I think it becomes less valuable information for those people who are intentionally using an opioid. But we are also seeing illicitly manufactured fentanyl contaminate the stimulant supply in Wisconsin and nationwide. And so I think they can be very helpful, especially for people who are not trying to use an opioid, but maybe being exposed to illicitly manufactured fentanyl through this sort of drug supply contamination.
UW-Madison Assistant Professor of Nursing Rachel Gicule researches substance use, researches drug overdose prevention and harm reduction. Join in at any point in the conversation. Call in with a question, your comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Drug overdose deaths are preventable. We learn about the latest efforts in Wisconsin for harm reduction and access to naloxone. That's the life-saving medication that can reverse an overdose from opioids. There's space to talk. Call in with your question. You can share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have epidemiologist Rachel Gicule, who is here. Rachel, let's talk about Narcan, the nasal spray version of naloxone that blocks an opioid's effects on the brain and reverses an overdose. There was the initiative launched last year in Milwaukee providing first responders with harm reduction materials, the kit that included naloxone. What challenges do cities face when funding harm reduction initiatives?
Many, but I will say, I think as our overdose crisis has gone on, naloxone or Narcan especially has become more and more of an accepted tool that is handed out by public health departments and others. The program that you were speaking out is kind of a leave behind program where people who experience an overdose or, you know, their social networks are often left with Narcan after that event. And so in places like Milwaukee and other areas around the state, I think it's a great initiative to make sure that people have access to that, perhaps with another overdose that they witness or experience themselves. We know that having an overdose is one of the strongest predictors of having a subsequent overdose. And so it's really important to reach people who use drugs who have experienced an overdose recently through initiatives like you were talking about in Milwaukee.
We've also seen installations of Narcan vending machines, you know, stocked with free Narcan and fentanyl test strips, you know, vending machines going in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country. What about this movement? What do you see there?
I think this is also an amazing initiative, again, that's in part made possible by the opioid settlement funds that have come into the state over the last year or so. These, one thing I really like about the vending machines is that they can offer anonymity. So you can go to the vending machine. You don't have to go to a provider and say, you know, I need some Narcan. And they're often put in very accessible places so that in some cases, even if someone were to witness an overdose, they could quickly get to the vending machine, get that naloxone or Narcan that they need and bring it back to the scene. With fentanyl, we see that people are overdosing a lot more quickly than they had been on heroin in past years before the drug supply had changed. So having that really quick access is actually super important. And again, having the opportunity to get Narcan without having to really say anything about yourself, about your need for Narcan, about your drug use, or who you're getting the Narcan for is really important for reducing stigma and shame around that.
And then the development earlier this year with the FDA approving Narcan as an over-the-counter medication, how accessible is it to people who are at higher risk of overdose?
Yeah, I think that's going to be something we need to carefully monitor as Narcan really starts to become available in pharmacies. From what I've seen so far, Narcan was approved for over-the-counter distribution in March by the FDA. We're still sort of waiting to see that it will become available in the final price, but it's anticipated to be around $50, which really could be pretty cost prohibitive for some of the community that uses drugs. And so I think, you know, over-the-counter Narcan is great, and that was such a positive development, I think, especially for normalizing having Narcan and sort of trying to change the narrative around thinking about it as this specialized medication. It's very safe. And so I think providing it over the counter makes it more like a Tylenol or an ibuprofen or something like that. However, that doesn't mean we can stop distributing Narcan or naloxone in places that people use drugs access now and where they can access it for free. So there I'm speaking about places like syringe service programs, which offer Narcan and training on how to use it, as well as many other wonderful services in a stigma-free environment. I think those are the programs that we need to keep going alongside this approval of over-the-counter Narcan.
Okay, so watching that price point, ensuring that it's affordable is something that you have your eye on there in the over-the-counter market aspect. You mentioned syringe service programs. How effective are they?
Very effective. Syringe services programs are really one of the least, they're meant to be one of the least stigmatizing spaces for people who use drugs, a place that really embodies kind of the ideals of harm reduction and meeting people where they're at, where someone can really go and access the services they may need to make sure that their drug use is as safe as possible. So beyond just accessing naloxone, they can get other safer drug use equipment like syringes, like fentanyl test strips. They also can get testing for infectious diseases like HIV and hepatitis C, wound care, and then very importantly, referrals to things like addiction treatment, mental health care, other social services like housing referrals. So through this sort of bundled set of services, they are actually highly effective in reducing mortality and helping people to lead a safer life while they're using drugs and afterwards if they decide to stop using drugs later on.
Rachel Gicule, an epidemiologist at UW-Madison, as we talk about reducing fatal drug overdoses and harm reduction strategies, you can still join in at 800-642-1234. Call in with a question, share your thoughts as well. Rachel, you mentioned stigma. How does stigma contribute to overdose risk?
In many, many ways. One framing that I like from the literature is that stigma is a fundamental cause of population health inequities. And so, as applied to overdose, what that really means is that stigma finds many, many pathways to impact the ultimate outcome of overdose through every effort that we may try. So treatment, it affects people whether they feel comfortable enrolling in treatment, whether they feel comfortable walking in the door of a syringe service program, whether they're willing to call 911 to get extra help when they witness an overdose. And so, stigma is really one of those pervasive risk factors. And the idea of a fundamental cause is that without addressing that fundamental cause of stigma, we will never actually fully address, an outcome like overdose mortality through the various programs that we devise. We really have to address that root cause of stigma to actually see the full improvement that we're trying to get. So I think a lot of the efforts to reduce the stigma of drug use are really key to realizing this goal of reducing overdose mortality.
And this can happen at the individual level. One person can make a change. I mean, what is the impact of using non-judgmental and supportive words and eliminating stigmatizing language from your own, from your own conversations?
Yeah, absolutely. We know in some of the literature, especially around healthcare interactions, that using a term like substance use disorder instead of substance abuse or substance abuser, that we see that clinicians perceive, less judgment around someone with a substance use disorder. And I think syringe services programs in their provision of non-judgmental, non-stigmatizing care really embody this idea that when you do that, people feel comfortable asking questions. They feel comfortable sticking around to get their training to use Narcan. And these really do have positive effects on overdose mortality.
We have very limited time left, but it is the year of mental health, the governor proclaimed. What could Wisconsin do in its next 2-year state budget to really prevent overdose deaths? What is a positive step that our state could take?
Yeah, I think I'll list two briefly. One is I think strengthening our Good Samaritan law to which protects people who witness an overdose from legal ramifications from calling 911, really trying to also offer protections to the person who overdosed themselves. And then also I think continuing to invest in harm reduction venues like overdose prevention centers would be an amazing harm reduction step for the state.
Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Rachel Gicule is an epidemiologist and an assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Nursing. Recovery from addiction is possible. For help, please call the free and confidential treatment referral hotline. It's 800-662-HELP. That's 800-662-HELP. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. 43 years ago this month, almost 15,000 Cuban refugees were sent to live in southwest Wisconsin. WPR dove into the history of the situation in the podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a preview of that podcast, which explores the lives of Cubans in Wisconsin.
Imagine, you're a 16-year-old kid thousands of miles from home. You've just stepped off a plane in Wisconsin. For the next few months, you'll be living at an army base. There are strangers, people who don't speak your language. It feels like you're living in prison. Your whole world has been uprooted. You think you're alone, far from family and friends, when suddenly you discover your father, who you've barely had a relationship with, is also at this military base in Wisconsin. This was the reality for Armando Rodriguez, who left his barracks at Fort McCoy daily to meet with his father, Guillermo Rodriguez.
I saw my dad on the other side of the fence, and we talked from afar. And we spent about a month and some like that.
Armando and Guillermo are from Cuba and had to live at Fort McCoy until they found a home in the United States. They were here in Sparta, Wisconsin, because of the Mariel boat lift. For 5 months in 1980, the Cuban government opened its borders and let its residents leave for the U.S. during the height of the Cold War. Almost 125,000 Cubans fled the island and landed in South Florida by boat.
She says more craft are expected to make the journey in what could build into a Dunkirk-like evacuation.
Because of that, the president yesterday declared a state of emergency in southern Florida.
There's a hopeful feeling that they will be allowed to stay in this country and to find jobs.
Many refugees left their homeland to find a better opportunity or escape Fidel Castro's communist government. Some wanted to be reunited with family. Others were plucked from jail and pushed onto boats.
We arrived here in Key West, and then we arrived at Fort McCoy. In Fort McCoy, I stayed for 5 months.
Armando was one of the nearly 15,000 people sent to Fort McCoy in Wisconsin before he found a home. Most of the Cubans who came to Wisconsin left the area after connecting with family or finding sponsors. But some people, like Armando, remained in southern Wisconsin. They created lives here as bus drivers, fathers, and musicians. Now, 42 years later, many of the refugees want to visit Cuba. People like Armando want to go just one more time, but they can't.
I've never been able to visit Cuba. I would like to visit Cuba. I'm not allowed to go. And if I go, I can't come back. I am in the same situation as everyone else who has committed a crime.
Yeah.
His friends in Wisconsin feel the same.
I'm 63 years old. Wow, times go fast, you know. And I haven't given up. I have faith.
The immigration, you know, give us a second chance. Why can those Cubans get a second chance?
Do you want to go back and visit also?
Yeah, I want to go see my mama before she died.
I can go to Cuba.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, I can go. Because
I was lucky. I never committed a crime. The only problem is when I want to do my passport, I talk to my sister to send my birth certificate. And when I see my birth certificate, that's wrong. That's not my name.
Because when I tried to kill him, I always say, you know, the reason I did it because I want to go back to Cuba.
I'm Maureen McCollum, and this is Uprooted, a new podcast from Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll hear from Cuban Wisconsinites who arrived here more than 40 years ago. These are the unheard voices behind the headlines. What were their lives like in Cuba? What was the journey like across the sea? What has life been like in Wisconsin? And after 40 years, where do they go from here? Subscribe to Uprooted wherever you get your podcasts, and you can see more at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And to find the Uprooted podcast, go to Season 3 of WPR Reports, wherever you listen to podcasts. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Hundreds of unionized journalists at Gannett Newsrooms walk off the job this week, holding a wave of nationwide strikes to demand a change of leadership and an end to deep cost-cutting measures. Gannett being the nation's largest newspaper chain with multiple publications here in Wisconsin. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dan Kennedy is here, journalism professor at Northeastern University in Boston. Dan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
And Davey Shastri is here, president of the Milwaukee Newspaper Guild and health and medical science reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Davey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Davey, Gannett journalists walking off the job, withholding bylines. We saw scenes around the country. Why didn't Gannett's Wisconsin publications follow suit and participate in the strike?
Right. That's a great question. So we have an established contract in Milwaukee that includes a no-strike clause. So while we are fighting for many of the same, improvements that our sister guilds across the country are, we simply have to do it in a different way.
And so when you say do it in a different way, how do you do that? How do you come to the table?
Yeah, so a lot of what we have been working on is just focusing in on our bargaining with our local managers. Again, fighting for many of the same contract, improvements that a lot of our partner guilds are also doing, better pay, tools to do our jobs, all those sorts of, trying to deal with cuts. And then we're also working to raise public awareness of our situation. We have an action network petition that people can sign and send a letter to our CEO. And so through things like that, we're able to kind of build awareness.
Dan, how are staff cuts at, Gannett Publications affecting news reporting around the country?
Well, the cuts have been absolutely devastating. I should say that here in Massachusetts, Gannett actually closed several dozen of the weekly papers that they had covering local communities. And they said, well, you can go online, but they also eliminated all local reporting and replaced it with regional reporting that nobody really cares about. And we see this in community after community across the country. Gannett has simply ceased to meet the news and information needs of local communities, even though the few journalists who are left continue to work very hard and do great work.
Davey, how are cuts affecting your newsroom at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel?
Yeah, we've faced significant cuts. Even just since looking back to 2020, our bargaining unit has been cut by about 25%. We were at 104 people in our bargaining unit, and now we're around 80. And just in the last year, we held off several rounds of cuts We had several people leave in voluntary buyouts, and that is also an issue for us because we lose a lot of institutional knowledge that way.
Dan, last year, Gannett reported almost $3 billion in operating revenue. It's down 7% from the year before. What do you make of the company's business structure and the company's business model?
Well, you know, I'm not even sure what their business model is anymore. It just seems to be to stay ahead of the declining revenues by cutting newsrooms in order to continue to meet their rather massive debt obligations, which they took on after they merged with Gannett. After Gannett merged with Gatehouse Media. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, frankly, to keep the big bucks rolling in for people at the top, the one day strike that we are talking about was begun with the goal of trying to convince Gannett shareholders to remove Michael Reed, who's the chair and the CEO of Gannett. Reed has been paid about $11 million over the past 2 years in salary and stock options and whatever else he's been getting. And it didn't work. I mean, the shareholders reelected Reed as chair in about 2 minutes, apparently. So I don't know if they really have any particular business model except to keep cutting and try to survive.
Keep cutting and trying to survive, Davey. Cutting staff, of course, means, you know, cutting stories, fewer stories. But beyond the obvious reduction of work output, what other changes occur when you dramatically shrink the size of your newsrooms?
Yeah, I think what you said is just the reality, right? The numbers are the numbers. And despite this, you know, the Journal Sentinel remains the largest newsroom in the state with an incredible reach and institutional power behind it. You know, we have national headliners awards. We have national business awards, magazine awards, 2022 Pulitzer finalist. Like, we are doing this work in spite of the decisions that this company is making. And, you know, that takes its toll. People are coming in every day and they're doing absolutely the best that they can. But what we want is stability. We want the tools that we need to do our jobs, and we want reliable pay and benefits that allow us to keep doing this for years to come. And we want that longevity and that retention in our newsroom of all of the talented people that we have.
Dan Kennedy, as an outsider looking in, how effective is the bargaining of News Guild as you look across the country as a bargaining unit and getting demands met?
The pay that Gannett journalists are getting is extremely low. I've seen figures as low as $40,000 for a full-time job. I think the News Guild is doing as much as they possibly can to fight on behalf of their members. But if you look at it strictly in terms of results, they're not getting very far because pay is low, benefits have been cut and suspended repeatedly, and people keep getting laid off. So it's a pretty ugly picture overall.
Northeastern University journalism professor Dan Kennedy there, and Davey Shastri, president of the Milwaukee News Guild, reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. That's a Gannett publication. Call in and share your perspective. Join in with a question, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As hundreds of Gannett journalists walk off the job this week protesting working conditions and company leadership, We hear from the president of the Milwaukee News Guild, Davey Shastri, and what the strike means for Wisconsin, what it means for the nation. Dan Kennedy here as well, Northeastern University journalism professor. You can add your voice to the conversation, call in with a question, share your comment at 800-642-1234. Davey, you alluded to this. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel last year was a Pulitzer finalist for its reporting on apartment fires. And we've certainly featured Milwaukee Journal Sentinel journalists on their groundbreaking stories many times through the years. Are recent cuts affecting newsroom morale?
I would say on some level, you have to ask, you know, individuals about that. But, you know, there is definitely a toll that comes from, you know, seeing our newsroom get cut over and over again. I can speak on a personal level and say, you know, that does wear on me as a young person trying to move up in the newsroom and learn from all the wonderful people who work here. And so I think there is a toll of that. But the reality is that we remain very strong in terms of the talent that we do have. And every day we go into work and see each other and talk to each other and make sure that, you know, we're keeping our spirits up and getting the work done. And so there's still so much potential in this newsroom that I see. And there's so much wonderful, caring people that working there that keep morale high in the face of all of the things that this company, all the decisions that this company has made. And, you know, that's not something we're going to give up easily. We care about this newspaper and we care about this community, and we're going to keep bolstering ourselves up to make sure that, you know, we're doing the best journalism that we can.
Dan Kennedy, you guide future journalists in this career track. Do they have trepidation about what's going on?
Well, of course they do. And they are wondering what sort of a future they have in the news business. But at the same time, I'm somebody who remains profoundly optimistic about where we're going. My research and writing is mainly on local news startups. And we've seen hundreds of them launched over the last 10 to 15 years. And that is a movement that is really accelerating. Most of them are nonprofit, but some of them are for-profit. Most of them are digital only, but some of them are in print. And I think that what we may be seeing as corporate chain owners like Gannett and some others, such as Alden Global Capital, communities are sort of taking this problem on for themselves and finding ways to solve it. And these are not, some of them are, but, you know, these are not all tiny little volunteer projects. A lot of them are substantial newsrooms that are hiring people at a living wage and, frankly, paying people more than Gannett is. So, yeah, of course students are concerned, but I do think that we are slowly heading toward a good place, even as we see the legacy Gannett newspapers continue to fade away, unfortunately.
Will that make any impact on the news deserts that have become so prominent in recent years?
Oh, absolutely. It is having an impact on news deserts. We see a number of news deserts turning into oases, you might say. One thing that does concern me is that the startup newsrooms that I'm talking about tend to be in more affluent urban and suburban areas, and we're seeing less being done for communities of color and rural parts of the country, although there are things happening there as well.
Dan Kennedy, Northeastern University journalism professor, Davey Shastri here, president of the Milwaukee Newspaper Guild, reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Davey, something that your guild was retweeting in recent hours, I think, and it's really intriguing to me, is withholding bylines. I mean, we're seeing the Indy Star reporters not allowing Indy Star to use their names on published work until further notice. What kind of pressure tactic is that?
Yeah, I think it's similar to, going on strike, but it sends a very clear message, right? What is the news without the people who do the news? As reporters, we put our names out there on everything that we do, as I'm sure you understand. And with that, we build, our brand, and we build trust in our reporting. And that has value. That's what, we remind our, managers and leadership as well. And that everybody seems, is aware of, is that, without reporters and photographers and, the people who are doing this work, there's no paper. And, it's a way to keep serving the community while also sending a very clear message that, what would happen if we're not there.
Dan, in a blog post this week, you noted that Gannett named a new vice president of local. What do you see the company trying to accomplish with this position?
That was kind of puzzling, wasn't it? Michael Anastasi of the Tennessean, which is a Gannett paper, was promoted to this position of vice president of local. And at the same time, we learned that Intiaz Patel, who's the CEO of the Baltimore Banner, one of our most highly regarded nonprofit news startups, is leaving for a yet unspecified top position at Gannett. So the news is not all bad, but it remains to be seen what is going to happen with these two positions. My suspicion is that what Gannett wants to do with these folks is to develop new types of regional, statewide, national news and feed them out to all of Gannett's newspapers, because there really hasn't been any sign that they want to double down on doing the kind of day-to-day community journalism that's really needed. Even so, it is a counter to the doom and gloom that normally comes from Gannett, and I think it bears watching.
Okay. We only have a few seconds left, Davey. But for outsiders looking into journalism, not in the industry, in a few words, what can you share to people saying, well, why should I care?
Yeah, I would just say that, your local reporters are your neighbors. We eat your food. We drink your water. We live in your neighborhoods, and we care about your community. And the survival and strength of the Journal Sentinel is the survival and strength of our state and our city. Mm. And so, that's what we are fighting to keep. That's what the Local 51 is fighting to keep every day when we go into work. And we are trying to make sure that our jobs don't get cut, that our work isn't outsourced, that we remain here doing this work. And so you can support us by you still subscribing, being a stakeholder.
And we have to let it go there. Thank you for joining us, Davey Shastri, president of Milwaukee Newspaper Guild, reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Dan Kennedy, journalism professor at Northeastern University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.